There's the magic gong. Bringing us into session for the afternoon. Any comments or questions?
Carl, I can't figure out how to do this. I'm sorry.
Okay. On your computer, do you have a key for muting? Well, she probably doesn't know Macintosh.
This is on the I thought I used it.
Okay, now let's see. Sounds like you used it. Now to talk, you'll have to unmute yourself, but then you can remute.
Oh, she got the phone on.
Oh, if you got the phone on, you're fine. I think you solved it. Yeah, if you got the phone, don't bother unmuting. Okay, with that in mind, let's hit the gong again. All right. Class is in session. Comments and questions before we move on. Well, our first session this afternoon is in the area of the arts, and we're talking about the light of inspiration. Today we're talking about the light of inspiration in writing. From art and music, we have learned to look for and detect the light of inspiration in behind these things, and now we're going to see how we can distill this to search for it in literature. The light of inspiration is not inherent in the words, nor is it something the author creates. The author creates a structure for it, but the light of inspiration is composed of the authority by which he writes, the insight that guides him, and the genius that brings these elements together to create something memorable. You can find this light of inspiration in an essay by Emerson, such as Great Men, or in a short story by Kenneth Morris, like Daffodil. But the easiest place to discern it is in great poetry. A poem can be short, such as the famous epigram by Alexander Pope. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. So, what's the light of inspiration in that? Anybody? Anybody at all?
Read it again.
Read it again? It was so long. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light.
Laws.
Right.
Rather
light. Okay. He was being an agent of light. And this, in two lines, encapsulates the whole idea of thinking and the use of thinking to explore life and become an agent of light. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. Night and light. See, this brings in the whole concept, Parmenides, logic, etc., night and light. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. Doesn't mean that we all were enlightened, but Newton revealed the existence of energy behind form. Okay? Anything?
It helps you understand the concept of night and light, that night is not a bad thing necessarily.
No.
It doesn't show the potential
sphere.
It needs to be revealed.
Right. It obscures, but it doesn't defeat.
I was reminded of that painting yesterday.
providing was turning the world of life.
Right. Very good.
Well,
yes.
It shows the importance of great men.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Some poems can be longer. I'm not going to give you a really long one. But comparative to that, we can go a little bit longer. There is a poem in Sophie 24. You can follow along if you can get out of the book. By Catherine Tynan, The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Okay.
Page 24. Page 24, Sophie 24. There's music in my heart all day. I hear it late and early. It comes from fields or far away, the wind that shakes the barley. Above the uplands drenched with dew, the sky hangs soft and parley. An emerald world is listening to the wind that shakes the barley. Above the bluest mountain crest, a lark is singing rarely. It rocks the singer into rest, the wind that shakes the barley. Oh, still through summers and through springs, it calls me late and early. Come home, come home, come home, it sings, the wind that shakes the barley. Okay, how does that express light? What's the light of inspiration shining through that?
It seems to be spirit.
I'm sorry?
The wind seems to represent spirit.
Especially
the poem, Come Home, Come Home. Maybe it's a play on, maybe it represents a couple of things. You know, because it could be the wind in physical life, but it also seems like the breath of spirit as well.
Well, I agree with you that Come Home, Come Home, Come Home is a key line here. So, what else? Other contributions?
Well, the very first line, to me, there's music in my heart all day.
Yeah.
That would mean you were connected to the soul. You were keeping yourself focused in the light of the soul.
Okay. Okay, anybody else? Those are good interpretations. However, you read down below, you'll find that she's an Irish poet.
Mm-hmm.
And barley is one of the key crops of Ireland. And the Irish spirit is represented by barley in their literature and whatnot. So it's clear from Come Home, Come Home, Come Home, she's out of the country. She's doing something nasty like living in England or France or someplace. And but she says, there's music in my heart all day. I hear it late and early. It comes from fields are far away, the wind that shakes the barley. The wind that shakes barley is something that she remembers from childhood. How the mature barley in the field, the wind would come through and literally shake the barley. That is an Irish experience of her Irish upbringing. And she's far away, she's expatriate now, but her heart still is in Ireland. And she's tuned into the Irish subconscious, and she's responsive to the spirit of Ireland. Above the bluest mountain crest, the lark is singing rarely. It rocks the singer into rest, the wind that shakes the barley. And through summers and springs, it calls me late and early. Come home, come home, come home, it sings, the wind that shakes the barley. So she recognizes her connection to what's happening in Ireland, even though she's not there. And she's influenced by Irish mass consciousness wherever she goes. She takes the heart and spirit, the essence of Ireland, with her wherever she goes. The Emerald World, yes, exactly. And she's identifying an experience that all Irish people have ingrained in their heart early on, ingrained being the pun. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on that? But that would be the light coming through, the spirit of Ireland shining through, uniting the Irish people. Now, of course, in her next lifetime, she'll talk about the wind that shakes the wheat or the corn. But for this lifetime, her identity is largely shaped by her Irish experience. All right, going on, poems that demonstrate the light of inspiration can even be crude. In Sophie 23, we have on page 70 the poem by Matthew Prior, On a Fart Led in the House of Commons. No reason why vulgarity can't be an adequate channel for the light of inspiration. After all, the light of inspiration is the authority of the inspiration. So this is told from the point of view of the fart. Reader, I was born and cried. I cracked, I smelt, and so I died. Like Julius Caesar's was my death, who in the Senate lost his breath. Much alike entombed does lie the noble Romulus and I, and when I died like Flora Fair, I left the Commonwealth my heir. Little play upon words there. So what's the light within this? The smell of corruption. Very good. Oh, okay. Very good. I hadn't read down there. That's the one. Yeah, well, honesty pays. This is one of the purposes of satire. Satire operates by lifting up common subjects and treating it as though they're divine. Like, you all remember the wonderful poem by Samuel Wesley on the grunting of a hog. Harmonious hog, warble thy anthem out. That's called hyperlesque. It lifts up an ordinary subject and treats it like it's very refined and elegant. Or it can take a example of pomposity and drag it through the ditches. That's what this does. This is low burlesque. Very good. Okay. It can be sublime. Let's see. We have somewhere Lilacs, same book, Sophie 23, page 36. Lilacs by Emily Dickinson. The lilac is an ancient shrub, but ancienter than that, the firmamental lilac upon the hill tonight. The sun subsiding on his course bequeaths this final plant to contemplation, not to touch, the flower of Occident. Of one corolla is the west, the calyx is the earth, the capsule's burnish sees the star, the scientist of faith. His research has but just begun. Above his synthesis, the flora unimpeachable to time's analysis. I hath not seen, may possibly be current with the blind, but let not revelation by theses be detained. Okay, what is the light of inspiration here? Anybody?
I guess beauty.
sunset, she's looking and she's identifying this lilac.
Okay. What would the firmamental lilac be?
That's what I was thinking. Just the sun itself.
Okay. Sure. It would be the archetypal lilac, the essence of the lilac, and what she's doing here is setting up a comparison that the lilac is just sunshine in form. In order for plants to grow, you need a seed, you need soil, you need water, and you need sunlight. And it's sunlight that causes the plant to grow and chlorophyll to be produced and so on. And so the lilac is an ancient shrub, but far more ancient than that is the archetypal lilac, which finds its life in the sun, subsiding on his course, and bequeathing to this final plant, the appearance of the plant, the ability to contemplate through the lilac, through the actual flower of the lilac, we can contemplate the realm of mind. We can contemplate the firmamental lilac by contemplating its final form. And this becomes the science of faith, to recognize that as above, so below. As below, we can find the correspondent above. That's the science of faith, as opposed to the science of observing only the physical lilac. His research has but just begun. Above his synthesis, the flora unimpeachable. Now, where have we just heard the word flora? Why, we heard it back in on a fart. Much alike a tomb, in tomb does lie the noble Romulus and I, and when I died, like flora fair, I left the commonwealth my heir.
Huh.
So, this demonstrates the great versatility of anything if we view it symbolically. Emily would probably be mortified to think that her lovely flora could be interpreted as the essence of a fart. But what that also means is that it's not the outer appearance that counts. It doesn't matter whether it's a fart or whether it's a lilac. It's our capacity to contemplate it and find the inner reality. In the case of the fart, corruption, and the case of the lilac, beauty.
So you need to develop clairsnifience.
Right. Rosa says you need clairsnifience. I would be more blunt. I would say you need clairsmellience. I hath not seen may possibly be current with the blind, but let not revelation by theses be detained. Now, that's as powerful as any line in David Mamet's book, The Secret of Knowledge. I hath not seen may be okay for a blind person to utter. It may be a popular sentiment. But let not revelation by theses be detained. Don't let your concepts get in the way of perceiving the light within what you're contemplating.
I was in a paragraph in the Kanye of Aurora Leaves to a lot of imagery.
Right. Yes, I don't recall any reference to flora, but absolutely. And it's important as you read, especially poetry, as I indicated this morning, it's important to think of those associations and let your mind entertain all kinds of associations as you read poetry, because they're all living in the same consciousness. And wherever you dip your oar, you can find a connection. All right. Humorous poetry can be an adequate channel for inspiration, a lot of inspiration. On page 110 in that same Sophie 23, we have my two parodies of Robert Frost, Fire and Ice. One half the world is racked with doubt, the other half by guilt. From what I've learned of wisdom's way, I understand how doubt holds sway. But if on doubt life's truly built, without design or thoughtful goal, then guilt is just as false as doubt and cracks the whole. And the second one, some say the world will end in frost. Others say, that's nice. From all the times I've had a chill, I know that frost can cause us ill. But let me not be misconstrued. I've suffered many an unwanted welt from folks who masquerade as good but hit below the belt. So, what's the light of inspiration here? Anyone? Well, go back to the original. Go back to Fire and Ice. Not that I have it here to... Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. What's the light of inspiration there? Anybody? Well, sure, doubt. I mean, the first one, the first poem is between one half the world is racked with doubt, the other half by guilt. And then putting up wisdom as the antithesis to both. From what I've learned of wisdom's way, I understand how doubt holds sway, but if on doubt life's truly built, without design or thoughtful goal, then guilt is just as false as doubt. And cracks the whole. Both of them cracks the whole. The idea here is that any distortion of any lack of wisdom leads to doubt or guilt. Doubt is, neither one of these is a useful approach to life. Doubt obscures wisdom, guilt obscures our basic goodness, and thereby cracks the whole. So it's wholeness that we're working with in the first one. And that's true in Fire and Ice as well. Fire and Ice are duality. He's playing upon the duality that some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. And then from what he knows of desire, he holds with those who favor fire, but if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice. So he's working with dualities there. These parodies, by the way, do not lessen the power or the greatness of Frost's poem in the least. Fire and Ice is one of my favorite poems, which is why I have it memorized. But some people read it and think it's a good poem and never bother to penetrate to the light of inspiration, and that's partly why I wrote these, to highlight the lack of comprehension in most readers of the Frost poem.
Well, in that first poem, could it mean that his question, what will destroy the earth, would it be passion, the fire, the desire, to be total ignoring, or passivity, which is worse?
Well, I think what you have to do is in terms of the Frost version, Fire and Ice, he's stipulating, some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice, but he's never saying it's going to end. The trick of this poem, as is often the case of Frost, is in order to fully understand this, you have to recognize that the assumption he's voicing, that he's heard other people make, is itself the target of the poem. The idea that the earth's going to end in some catastrophe is itself absurd. And he uses that platform to say, well, either one would work, but why assume that it's going to end in catastrophe? That's implied because, well, it's by implication. He pretty much says they would both work, but, you know, why? So, again, that's answered in the first one here of mine. They're both false, and either one would crack the hole. But as long as we have our eyes focused on the hole of everything, there's no catastrophe. And then the second one is even, obviously there's the pun on Frost here. Some say the world will end in frost. Others say, that's nice. Those are the people who don't read poems. From all the times I've had a chill, I know that frost can cause us ill. But let me not be misconstrued. I've suffered many an unwanted welt from folks who masquerade as good but hit below the belt. I don't know whether you have... Yes?
I was just going to say, is it that you're looking at overall life is really good, even though there are the challenges and people behave and say and do things and play, they hit below the belt, they don't follow divine teachings or whatever, they're not bringing out their best self.
Right.
But that's okay. Our duty is to keep going forward and trying to bring out our good and their good.
Right. If it's difficult to imagine, a perfect example of this is Schweitzer, who believed in the reverence for all life, kinship of life, worked amongst animals and flies and insects, and he never killed anything. As I recall, he'd never swat a fly. Never swatted a fly or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is his work was so great that to accuse him of swatting a fly or something like that is to be caught up in triviality. And people read great poetry without comprehending the wholeness, as we saw in Emily's poem about lilacs. You can get all caught up in the details. But we just have to learn to take life in stride. The objections of other people, the criticism of other people, maybe like mosquitoes attacking you, and you can brush them away. You don't have to respond to them. You don't have to kill them. They don't count. And so these guilt and fear in the first one, or guilt and doubt in the first one, niceness and the chilliness in the second one, they just don't count. You just take them in stride and you keep doing your work. Did you have something to listen?
Oh, I don't know. I was just, this last part reminded me of yesterday, our encounter while being stuck in a room and listening to a conversation of someone who was thinking he was a Christian and that this other person who had offended him was not behaving like a Christian, and he was standing there and, ooh.
There's a lot of feedback somewhere. Okay, yeah.
He was standing there just, I mean, if you can, the plate in Man Visible and Invisible would describe what his aura looks like. It
sure.
was gray with black clouds and lightning bolts that were going out, and just that poor person must have just did not know what hit him, the way he was condemning him for having offended this person.
Sure.
And
well,
that would be, he was masquerading as this Christian, and he was just dumping all over this other person.
Right, which brings to mind C.S. Lewis' Screwtape Letters, and how people who think themselves to be good Christians go around criticizing other people, wasting other people's time, being totally insignificant. When I reread this today, I thought of, I don't know whether any of you saw this, but we happened to tune in to the TV during lunchtime, and there was Harry Reid masquerading as good but hitting below the belt, saying, "The only compromise is my bill." Think about that for a moment. He was chastising the Republicans for their unwillingness to compromise, and he was saying, "It's my way or the highway. Only I have the interest of the country at heart." And it was such an ooh-ha-ha moment. He was standing there pompously saying, "The only compromise is my bill." I mean, even Harry Reid, that's a new low for arrogance.
Carl, I was just thinking you should pass the second moment to the Tea Party guys right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so there is light within those poems. Or we can take a poem such as Robert Browning's Pippa's Song. "The years at the spring and days at the morn, mornings at seven, the hillsides dew pearl, the larks on the wing, the snails on the thorn, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world."
Sounds like the order of the universe.
Sounds like the order of the universe at work, yes. Who else?
That's something the environmentalists would not understand.
Or liberals in general. Anybody? I'll read it again. "The years of the spring and days of the morn, mornings at seven, the hillsides dew pearled, the larks on the wing, the snails on the thorn, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world."
Or as Pope would say, whatever is right.
Whatever it is right. All right, I'll go with that. Anybody, any comments, insights?
Just going back to the theme of no matter what's going on in daily events, you can wake up, all's right with the world, and start with that kind of energy again. Try to bring it back into your daily living.
Uh-huh. Very good. Yes, I think
that... I were on the same track. I was thinking it was like a stanza from an integrated person.
Mm-hmm.
Who just is at one with the world. What is the person?
Yes. Well, in fact, it's a little bit more than that. This echoes Plato's Once Again from the Beginning, because it starts out the years at the spring, the days at the morn, mornings at seven, the hillsides dew pearled, there's still dew on the ground, the sun hasn't evaporated. The lark's on the wing, the snail's on the thorn, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. So the new day brings new beginning, and no matter what's gone before, there's nothing but potential and opportunity that lies in the future. Good. And then, as a final example here on this session, William Butler Yeats. I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. Nine bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud lay. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales in the morning to where the crickets sing. There are midnights all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wing. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway, or on the pavements gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core.
Is that also going back to the beginning and getting refreshed from the source and then going back out?
Right. I think it would be going back to first principles, to basic fundamentals. I will go, arise and go now and go to the lake where I can build a cabin of clay and wattles and farm beans and live off the honey hive and live in, alone in nature. It's almost Thoreau life. Yes. Rose.
Could you think of it as he's just getting ready to step out of his physical body?
One could say that he's getting ready to step out of his physical body. And that would be a legitimate thing. The line that makes the poem is the very last line. I hear it in the deep heart's core. Mm-hmm. I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavements gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. In a lot of ways, this is similar to the first poem, Catherine Tynan. Well, the second poem.
It's the coming home.
It's the listening to what Spirit tells us in our deepest recesses, in our heart, in our core. And always going back to listen to the signs and symbols of Spirit speaking. So that that puts us in tune with the light of inspiration. A great poem should always lead us back to the deep heart's core, where we can experience the light of inspiration that moved the poet to write. The point of looking for the light of inspiration in art, music, and literature is to cultivate the habit of discerning the real behind the symbol. All of human thinking is a symbol for the light of the mind of God. The thinking, and I'm precise in that, all of human thinking. I'm not talking about feeling or opining or grieving or mourning or being depressed. I'm talking about human thinking. All of it is a symbol for the light of the mind of God. The thinking person is one who automatically connects with the larger picture that underlies the outer performance. Any further comments on discerning the light within, light of inspiration within writing? Yes?
I was thinking about Thoreau, and that's why he originally wrote the Walden Pond, from which you have Walden Grove, in a way.
Right. Well, I actually derived the Walden is actually named after Waldo, the middle name of Ralph Waldo Emerson. That Walden Pond was owned by Emerson, and he let his friend Thoreau go and live in a little cabin that he had on that. But it was Emerson's property. And so that's just a little tidbit of information, but that's where the Walden comes from.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The Walden comes from Waldo, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and the Grove comes from the fact that Plato always taught in the Academy, which was a park with a grove of trees, and he held classes in the Grove. So a Walden Grove is a class about thinking, or a school about thinking, that illuminates the principles and ideas of Plato and Emerson and others. Okay, anything else?
Just that I'm really appreciating learning more through poetry and how to read poetry and think about it.
Good. That's what I hope for.
We had a wonderful class on time, too. And the class you did on poetry working with
it
very much
enjoyed that. Yeah, that was a long time ago. Yes. Good. All right. I'm sorry?
I was just thinking, if it's long ago, I know it was.
Yeah, Waldo was, the cat was named after Ralph, but we didn't think that Ralph was a good name for a cat. So. No offense to Ralphs, but normally cats respond to two-syllable names, not one.
Yeah.
Okay, time for our next class. I need to get another picture up here, don't I? Let's see. I don't know how well this one will enlarge, but we'll give it a shot. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know whether we give it a solution. There we are. This is an allegory of peace. And I went looking for it when I was looking for things on allegory for this morning. But I held it out for this afternoon because this is our session on the history, the evolution of peace, the history of peace. And I thought, well, we'll show this allegory of peace. I'm not quite sure that it is all that easy to see all the symbolic messages, but the leader there who's establishing peace is connecting, almost like the two swords over the shoulder and the five of swords. He's connecting with one hand to the spirit of peace, Pacifica, and to the people with the other hand. So he's a conduit for peace on earth. And it's a revelation. But anyway, today we're talking about approaching the history of peace in terms of commerce. It may sound odd to study commerce in examining the history of peace, but keep in mind that my definition of peace is the ability to work efficiently with a multitude of forces or people to produce a result, making right things happen. And it's not the absence of war. It's nice to have the absence of war, but peace can occur in wartime and in peacetime as well. There are a few better demonstrations of this concept of order than a profitable business enterprise. And because after all, a business enterprise requires the ability to work efficiently with a multitude of forces and people to produce a result, i.e. profit. And if you examine the roots of commerce, anybody have an idea what the etymology of commerce is? It's com plus mercy. See, merce, M-E-R-C-E. Calm plus mercy. Now, mercy is a word that we have our definition of in English, mercy, but in French, I believe it is the capacity to earn wages. Matter C is thanks. That's your wage. And so it's the working together to produce the fruits of your labors. Working together to create prosperity is therefore one of the great achievements of peace. And any history of peace should include a thorough study of commerce. Now, here's a question to start off with. What encourages this ideal of working together better? Would it be communism or capitalism? Or perhaps something else? The ideal is working together to produce prosperity. What system is better prepared to do this? Capitalism or communism, and why? Anybody? Okay. Why do you say that? Maybe I'm sorry? Okay, anybody want to comment on that or go on to a different aspect of the question? Communism, capitalism, which works better to create peace?
I would vote for capitalism.
Good.
Because you get the fruits of your own labor in that case. And usually when people do that, that is where the greatest philanthropy comes from. And the greatest kindness comes from people that have achieved, are willing to share.
Now, how did philandering get into this?
Philanthropy!
Oh, philanthropy! Well, fill this, fill that. Okay, anybody else?
Well, in doing my research at lunchtime, I find out the law of economy. No, I came across disciples is composed of financiers and economists, and they will work with the energies and forces which express themselves in the interchange and values of commerce.
And which group was this?
It's the ninth group of disciples.
Ah.
The nine unknowns.
The law of supply.
The nine unknowns.
I think you've stumbled across the esoteric meaning of the nine unknown. Because the nine unknown are the secret owners of all the wealth on the planet. But that's from a spiritual point of view. Okay, good. The
people of sharing, which is connected to what Judy was just talking about.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the left takes that idea, the communist takes that idea and says, well, we're going to impose sharing, which of course means it's not sharing at all. The communism, in fact, takes the central idea of communism is that the state owns everything, the individual owns nothing. And then the benevolent-hearted state gives you what you need, but it's shared misery, not shared prosperity.
However, that does appeal to people who don't want to work.
Right. It appeals to people who don't want to work, and it appeals to people who feel guilty about doing better than everybody else. And whereas capitalism embodies the idea of working together to create abundance, and then the ideal is to share it through philanthropy and do good works for the community. Whereas communism promotes zero-sum thinking, there's no such thing as creating wealth in communism. The state owns it all. And, of course, the state is non-productive, so it can't create new wealth. It can take over General Motors, but it can't invent the car. Only individual people working in response to the voice of inspiration can invent a car. And so communism ends up redistributing the wealth that exists, but never creates or adds to prosperity. And so communism violates the basic command of be fruitful and multiply. There may be fruitfulness, but there's no multiplication. There's no creation of new, there may be work, but there's no prosperity. Can you give examples of commerce promoting the welfare of humanity? Okay, how so?
Well, he took the fruits of his labor, and he decided how he could improve the lot of humanity.
Okay.
His wealth.
All right. And in fact, he devoted the last 20 years of his life to distributing his wealth according to his own concepts. All right. Other examples of, if we were to write the history of commerce and wanted to give key examples of promoting welfare of humanity, what would they be?
What about the idea of producing more so that you can trade it, share it within sort of the commerce system, so that you're going beyond, say, your small community, and the trading business aspect of selling your product increases your motivation to produce more?
Sure. You're not just producing for yourself, you're producing for yourself plus as many other people as you can produce for. That is a fundamental concept of capitalism. And the selfishness is in the communist system where you produce a certain quantity but the state seizes it all and you may not get any of it. Rose.
Well, it would be anything where someone would be taking a risk. But what popped into mind was the, you know, waiting for your ship to come in.
Yes.
The reason they were waiting is they had invested maybe everything.
Sure.
In that ship coming back.
Right.
I was thinking of Henry Ford, because he made his car so affordable that
okay. Well, in fact, you can say that Henry Ford transformed life in America in a very dramatic way because the car gave individuals personal freedom, the freedom to live in the country and work in the city, the freedom to get out of the city, the freedom to go from city to city, increased mobility. It's now very, during the Depression, the people who lost their farms in Oklahoma could migrate to California. It would have been very difficult without the car.
Well, no, we can't.
As Rose said, we've all said it took a risk. And to quit.
Right.
And that's what happened to Henry
Ford. Now, we can't forget Al Gore inventing the internet.
Al Gore inventing the internet. All right. There's a difference.
He belongs on an iceberg with those.
Yeah. Judy?
I would bet 99 out of 100 symphony orchestras and museums and ballet companies across the company in across the country in towns of all sizes were started as the result of commerce.
Oh, sure.
People who were successful who lived there who wanted to do something substantial for the community.
And what college does not have an endowment filled by donations from business and commerce?
Exactly.
So
cultural-wise, I think you can say really has been lifted.
Right, and that was true in the Renaissance in Italy. There were patrons that gave huge sums of money to promote the arts. The art world and the educational world and the intellectual world cannot exist without a strong commerce. It's the fruits of commerce that support philosophers, thinkers, pointy-headed intellectuals like Al Gore, etc. I would say that a couple of good examples would be, we must remember that the only reason why the New World was discovered was Columbus was searching for a better trade route to the Indies. The motivation was commercial. It wasn't that Ferdinand and Isabella called him forth and said, Chris, we want you to sail out and find out what you can find out. There was no altruistic motive there. It was, let's find a cheaper route to the Indies, because every time we go overland through the Silk Route, our traders get beat up and killed by terrorists. And also, this country itself was founded, we tend to think that this country was founded primarily by religious sects escaping religious persecution. And certainly Massachusetts was founded that way, but Virginia was founded on commercial purposes. The James River Plantation was a commercial establishment, the first colony. And Georgia was founded and chartered for commercial development. So our country itself was founded on a commercial impulse. Marco Polo went to China for commercial reasons.
Sure. I was going to mention that he and his brothers, they were all traders.
Yeah. The railroads... I'm sorry?
Canada probably was the trading company too, the Hudson Bay Company.
Right. The Canada was... The major interest in Canada until the U.S. got thriving was for fur traders.
That's right. Also, India, in all of the colonies that the British Empire had throughout the world, were generally based on commercial.
Yes. And that's true about South America, too. Spain colonized South America in order to bring back gold and other things. The railroads were built not so much to move people as to provide reliable routes for commercial transport, shipping goods. Commerce drives most human innovation. Google, Facebook, Twitter, these are all modern conveniences that didn't exist 10 years ago. Print on demand is a commercial enterprise that didn't exist 10 years ago. In this context, we can observe that commerce thrives on competitiveness, whereas communism tends to impose monopoly. And even in a capitalist society, monopolies create stagnation and stifle the creation of wealth. They should be broken up not for liberal reasons, but for the spread of creative energy. But what are some of the hidden aspects of commerce as a guardian of peace? The guardian of peace. How does commerce serve as a guardian of peace?
Well, the fact that we need other countries to fulfill some things that we may not have here,
Okay. Betty, were you going to say something?
I was going to say something similar to what Nikki just said. That, you don't want to mess with the people that you need to do business with, or they need to do business with.
Right. Any other observations there? Well, it's this commercial urge that is far more effective in promoting harmony and interaction. Who would have thought 50 years ago that from this point forward for the next several years, any exploration of space that we do with manned flight will be in cooperation with the Russians and has been in cooperation with the Russians for some time. Now, that's not exactly commerce, but there are a lot of ways that we cooperate commercially with the Russians and with, in fact, Russia would like to have the highest level of recognition as a trading partner. It would help them. China, too. So there are a lot of ways in which this helps antagonists to become harmonious. Did you have something?
Oh, I was just recalling an article I read to you some time ago. I don't know the name of the government program, but it brings people, kids from other countries over here for like summer jobs or whatever. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Now it's mostly Chinese that were taking up all the positions. But the article was because then people were upset because these kids were taking all the summer jobs and then kids here didn't have jobs. But that's, you know, bringing people back and forth and...
Yeah, there's a lot of exchange that way.
For commerce.
It encourages people to learn the language of trading partners.
Right.
It encourages, for example, in this country, we now have Honda, we have Toyota, we have Kia, we have all the Daewoo, we have these places building plants, hiring American workers, and that's a win-win situation for their countries and ours. The commercial world today does more to promote growth and development of the mind than either education or religion. In fact, yes.
Well, the other thing is how now businesses say that when they hire people, they basically have to retrain them because education has done such a rotten job, they've got to take on education.
Right. And even in terms of simple things about learning to make decisions on the job, they have to train people in basic thinking skills. Commerce has done more to shatter bigotry and inequality than government or religion. It is business that has taught blacks and whites and Chinese to work side by side and overcome their bigoted upbringing. It is commerce that gives a motive to learn to get along, integrated women into the workforce within just a generation. A very rapid change. It's the commercial world that is accelerating growth and change in the way we think and approach life. And to bring in Judy's point, it has led directly to the rise of philanthropy and the spread of goodwill through the support of charities, to the point where we need to start weaning these activities from the government, start demonstrating that the private sector can take care of many of these issues better than government. The commerce was responsible for the development of the printing press, which also then had the benefit of spreading literacy. But it was it was developed and refined for commercial purposes. Commerce has emphasized pragmatism and results when science has tended to drift off into the realms of theory. It is an ideal vehicle for the redemption of matter. It is commerce that drills for oil, refines it into gasoline and other products, and then sells it to consumers. In this way, mankind is tapping the latent energy of the planet and learning to use it to produce power, heat, fuel, etc. And every one of us can observe that the only thing government does in this process is stand in the way of exploiting the oil that we have. And it does that in the name of protecting the environment and protecting our sensibilities, but it harms our economy and prevents the full flower of our potential, our market's potential. At its best, commerce aids in the process of the work of God. Most of commerce does not, of course, do this because people spend money foolishly. But you can say exactly the same thing about religion, government, and every other aspect of civilization. The failing is the failing on the part of individual people, not commerce. Commerce has the ability. I would propose, this is just one of those what-ifs, it's purely speculative, but I would humbly suggest that one way to resolve the tensions that we find in the Middle East would be to reward Arabs and Jews for learning to work together in commercial enterprises. This could be done by large companies setting up factories or production facilities, say in the Gaza Strip or somewhere, that would employ Jews and Arabs alike, pay them extremely well to be productive and manufacture, and of course teach them to give them an incentive to get along with one another. There would be some problem of Hamas trying to blow it up, but it would be necessary to hire both Jews and Arabs to make sure that didn't happen. There might be few volunteers to begin with, but if the benefits were attractive, it would soon break down the barriers. After all, how many people went over voluntarily to work as private contractors in Iraq during the middle of the Iraq War because they were being paid insanely high salaries to do so? How many people go to Alaska to work on the pipeline because they're paid insanely high salaries? The same principle could work. It's worked inside Israel where Arabs and Jews live in harmony and work in harmony. The only problem is that there are Arabs that haven't learned that lesson that live outside of Israel and want to attack it. So commerce is a powerful force and needs to be utilized as a means of solving more of the world's problems. There was a what was it we were just reading? It's in here. It's in here. We'll get to it next period in the secret knowledge. But there was a footnote, or he mentions a woman from Gambia, I think it was Gambia, who said that the foreign aid to her country was preventing her country from developing a commercial infrastructure which would let them prosper on their own. That handouts deter growth, not encourage it. And another what if, and that is that if Obamacare is not repealed, I think the way to handle it is for American doctors to establish hospitals and clinics just over the Rio Grande in Mexico, where they can practice without being under the onus of Obamacare, and Americans looking for real health care can cross the border, get treatment, and come back, and that might even wipe out the drug cartels, because the drugs would be available legally. Anyway, that's any further comments or insights into commerce as a force of peace? I think all innovation occurs primarily in a commercial setting. I find it absolutely boneheaded for the government to give grants to artists, to musicians, to writers and whatnot, in the belief that they're promoting art. They're simply making people dependent upon the government, and private philanthropy and commerce does a much better job. Other insights, comments?
Just expanding on the idea of the car, and someone had mentioned the Wright brothers and the airplane, just how much that has shrunken the globe, the ability to have commerce between countries.
Sure. Think of the changes that have occurred since we were children. Now, there were cars and there were planes, but it is now so common and so easy, and air travel and so on is so inexpensive that it's a simple matter for me to fly out to Orange County and teach a class, which I'm going to do in a month. I've done that before. I've flown into many different cities and areas, New Jersey and Connecticut and Albuquerque, wherever that is. And I've taught because an airliner could take me there and so cost effectively that I could teach, and people could take the course. But a step further than that, as a result of commerce and the development of things, I can sit here and I can teach this course in Walden Ultra and seminars and whatnot through GoToMeeting, none of which existed 10 years ago. The computer capacity didn't exist. There were computers, but not with that ability. I can further sit here in working with my computer, and I can now send computer files to the printer. The printer takes it, converts it into a book, and it's all done without having to actually involve any non-electronic transfer of information from me to the printer. These are remarkable developments that have made the spread of knowledge and information far easier. And of course, it also meant that since Dorothy hadn't received her copy of The Fable Gate, I could email her an ebook version of it so that she could participate in the class. Has it arrived yet?
Yes, it came yesterday.
Well, there you go. Excellent. The post office will still work. However, you know, this is where thinking comes in terms of, say, the post office. Why do we have a monopoly? It would be far better if we allowed FedEx and UPS and anybody else who wants to compete with the Postal Service, and it wouldn't necessarily put the post office out of business. It would just force them to adopt commercial principles. Early in for the first 20 years or so of our existence as REO Press, we did lots of mass mailings through the post office. Bulk rate. And we'd have to get a permit, which cost us $125 or $175 a year. And we'd have to get a permit to use an imprint, which cost another $175. And then we'd have to print up everything just so, according to their specs. And then they would deliver them, slow boat, take 3 or 4 weeks usually to go out. But that's the way we advertised our books. And now, finally, we stopped doing this a few years ago because the cost was just getting too exorbitant. We weren't getting the payback that we were looking for. But finally, the new postmaster, faced with billions of dollars of debt every year, has directed the post office to simplify the bulk rate process and eliminate the permits, eliminate the fees, eliminate the stamp, the marking, and make it easy for businesses to do mass mailings. That's just the application of common sense business principles. But up until this time, the post office is always taking the assumption, you want to do business with us? Here's how you do business with us. It's our way or the highway. And they were driving away their best customers. And so finally somebody came in with enough business sense to say, that's crazy. Let's make it easy for the consumer to use our services. That's commerce at work. And the monopolies are the enemy of commerce. A free market is the best way to redistribute wealth. Okay. Oh, yes, I saw that too. The car that flies. You realize that now that you made that comment, I'm going to have to hit the gong all over again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, that's the end of the period. Let's resume in 10 minutes, 3:33.